A1,
the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Today on the program, Susan Shand brings us a story on Mexico's fight against obesity. Obesity is the condition of being medically overweight. Jill Robbins brings us the education report. I will bring you this week's words and their stories. Finally, we will end our 30 minutes together with Steve Ember and the making of a nation. Now, let's hear from Susan Shand.
Several Mexican states have proposed or approved bans on junk food sales to children. The country has one of the highest rates of childhood obesity, as well as a high rate of death for young people. The Gulf Coast state of Tabasco passed restrictions on the sale of sugary bottled drinks and snacks that are high in carbohydrates. Lawmakers in several other states have introduced bills to do the same. Most of the bans would stop the sale of junk food to young people unless their parent is present. In the northern state of Chihuahua, Representative Rene Frias introduced a bill to guarantee our children and youths a healthier diet and to fight obesity. The bill has not yet been voted on. In Mexico City, Mayor Claudia Sheinbaum said earlier this month that leaders there are working to put together similar laws. The issue has become important because of the coronavirus pandemic. Mexico has the third highest confirmed COVID-19 deaths in the world, behind the United States and Brazil. The government has said that high blood pressure and obesity are the main conditions that may have caused the disease to become more severe. But what exactly is junk food? That is the main problem for the writers of the new laws. Oaxaca is still working on its list, mostly because there are a lot of traditional Mexican foods that have a lot of sugar, salt, and calories. The lawmakers want to avoid banning traditional sweet foods. Instead, they have blamed packaged foods made by major international companies. The UN Children's Fund says child obesity is a health emergency in Mexico. It says the country's children have the highest rate in the world of junk food eating. Many young people there get 40% of their total calories from junk food. I'm Susan Shand.
And now, Dr. Jill with the Education Report.
Teachers everywhere are facing the new school term with one big problem: how to teach students safely in the middle of a worldwide pandemic. Hamisu Hamisa Haruna teaches English at Al-Kalam University in Katsina, Nigeria. He says that when the pandemic came, he did not hesitate or slow down to make changes to the way he was teaching.
I believe with one thing, that everything imaginable is attainable, and there is no what impossible. What matters is trying. You try and try until you get the right thing. So although progress is coming steadily, but surely nothing is impossible for me.
Haruna added that he told other educators about online programs, occupational training, and conferences to help them move their teaching online. He himself learned new skills from the U.S. State Department's e-teacher program. It offers free online classes for teachers outside the United States in cooperation with U.S. colleges and universities. One of the biggest problems with going online in Nigeria is the cost of data for cellular phone users.
And in order to come up with a solution to the problem of that high cost of data, we usually use WhatsApp platform by recording our lectures and sending the lecture to them.
Haruna said that after teachers record two lectures and publish the recordings online, they often use video conferencing to talk with students. Haruna reports that both students and their parents have reacted well to this method of teaching. Another teacher who took part in the e-teacher program is Egypt's Shireen Mohammed. She records her classes by using an interactive device at school. Then, students have two ways to get the teaching materials. They can watch them on YouTube, or for those lacking an internet connection, the school provides a compact disc, CD, or a data storage device with the recordings. To make sure her students are learning, Mohammed says they have to take tests that she creates on the KIA website or on Quizlet. Yet she warns that it is not wise to only use these online platforms.
I think it will be very difficult to make some assessment for my students. They must have some exams, real exams, to evaluate their progress. How can I evaluate it online? It will be very difficult.
In the Philippines, the new school term has been delayed until October 5th. Glenn Cortezano teaches at the Los Baños campus of Laguna State Polytechnic University. She said she led an online class to help teachers move to the new normal.
We know that learning should never stop, right? And we should always find ways. We always find ways, even we cannot meet face-to-face.
Cortezano is part of a team of curriculum checkers. They examined the education program of all the teachers. The biggest problem, Cortezano says, is organizing classes that require special skills or equipment.
How about the physical education subject? How can you teach swimming? How can you teach sports, dancing?
Glenn Cortezano, Shireen Mohammed, and Hamisa Haruna have all completed the U.S. State Department's e-teacher program. They lead training programs on using technology for teaching online. For more information on the next 8-week summer program and events in the coming year, contact the U.S. Embassy near you. I'm Jill Robbins.
And now, words in their stories from VOA Learning English. Today, we go back to school. We will talk about two terms from science class. Both are tests. But don't worry, you will not be tested at the end of the program. The first term is litmus test. The second is acid test. In science, we use both to determine the chemical makeup of something. In conversation, we use them to determine other things. One identifies where something belongs or whether it is acceptable. The other determines if something is real or good. But before we tell you which is which, let's talk about their meanings. First, litmus test. Now, you may remember doing experiments with litmus paper in a high school science class. Litmus paper is used to identify whether a solution is an acid or a base. The Merriam-Webster website says scientists have long known that litmus paper turns red in acidic solutions and blue in alkaline or base solutions. In fact, scientists have been performing tests with litmus paper since the 14th century. Litmus itself comes from lichen, a small plant that grows on rocks and trees. Today, many English speakers use the term litmus test in conversations. To them, it means something you use to judge whether someone or something is acceptable. So a litmus test is a kind of sign or indicator. It helps you identify in which category something belongs or in which direction something will go. It helps you group things together. Here's an example. A friend of mine has a single litmus test for dating, her dog. Her dog must like the man, and he must like the dog. After several failed relationships, she found this litmus test to be the one sure indicator of a good fit. Our second scientific expression is acid test. Such a test proves the value, quality, or truth of something. An acid test can take many forms. It can be an important job or a difficult situation. It shows if someone or something is good enough to succeed. For example, beating the national champions was the acid test for the basketball team. It showed the team's players they were better than the champs, even for only one game. An acid test can also find out whether something is as good as people say it is, whether it works, or whether it is true. For example, a restaurant may look nice, but will people eat the food? Good question. That is the acid test. An acid test also can test the value of something. For example, I wanted to take an online writing program, but I wasn't sure if it was worth the money. Then I found out that 80% of the people who took the class got a book deal. That was enough of an acid test for me. The term acid test also comes from an experiment, one involving gold. Some people say it dates back to the use of nitric acid to determine the gold content of jewelry. So those are the two tests, litmus and acid. But don't mix them up. They are different. A litmus test determines how to categorize something. In other words, where does it fit? An acid test determines if something is real, valid, or high quality. Let's go back to our dog example. When choosing a partner, the woman's litmus test is her dog. That puts the man in one of two groups, the she will date him category or the she will not date him category. But this does not really prove if he is a good choice. So it is not an acid test. The man never said he would be the perfect partner for her, so his validity is not being tested. And he might be a perfectly good partner for someone else, someone who doesn't like dogs. And that's Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
I kept my eyes open and tried to see of what went on in front of me. I kept what moved.
forgot about the rest. I took my young imagination to the acid test. It was easy then.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document established a loose union of the 13 states. Instead, the leaders wrote a completely new constitution. They created America's system of government and recognized the rights of its citizens. Last week, we discussed the way the delegates agreed that states would be represented in the national government. There would be two houses in the legislature. In one house, the House of Representatives, the number of representatives from each state would depend on the state's population. In the other house, the Senate, all states would have an equal number of representatives. The agreement on representation was known as the Great Compromise. Not all the delegates in Philadelphia were pleased with it, but it saved the convention from failure. The debate on representation in the House raised an important issue. No one wanted to talk about it, but all the delegates knew they had to discuss it. The issue was slavery. There were thousands of slaves in the United States in 1787. Most of them were in southern states. But there were many slaves in the north, too. And northern ship owners made a lot of money by importing slaves from Africa. A modern-day Supreme Court justice, Clarence Thomas, came from a family whose ancestors included slaves. Justice Thomas says slavery made no sense in America.
How can you have a free country with slaves? We understood that. It's a contradiction. It contradicts the very founding premise of the country.
The Articles of Confederation said nothing about slavery. Each state could decide to allow it or not. Massachusetts, for example, made slavery illegal. Nine other states stopped importing new slaves. Only three states, Georgia, North Carolina, and South Carolina, continued to import slaves. The issue was never easy to discuss. Some of the most important men in America, including George Washington and James Madison, owned slaves. No one wanted to insult these men, yet the delegates at the convention had to make some decisions about slavery. Slavery affected laws on trade and taxes, as well as the question of representation in Congress. If the number of representatives in the House was based on a state's population, who would you count? Would you count just free people, or would you count slaves too? Akhil Reed Amar, a professor of law and political science at Yale University, calls slavery the original sin of America's founders.
They inherited it, to be sure, and they worried about it, but not enough.
During the debate,
some delegates argued that slaves were property and should not be counted for purposes of representation. Others argued that slaves were people and should be counted with everyone else. Governor Morris of Pennsylvania made an angry speech. He denounced slavery as an evil institution. Charles Pinckney of South Carolina defended the existence of slavery in the United States. In all ages, he said, one half of mankind have been slaves. George Mason of Virginia, a slave owner, wanted to free all slaves. He said Virginia attempted to do that when it was a British colony, but that the British government refused. He blamed the problem on British businessmen who made money from slavery. Other delegates rose to denounce or defend slavery, but no one at the convention had the power to rule on whether slavery was right or wrong. Everyone knew the convention would fail if they tried to write a constitution that banned slavery. The southern states would never accept it. They would refuse to be part of the United States. Rufus King of Massachusetts said, "The convention should consider slavery only as a political matter." And that was what happened. The delegates accepted several political compromises on the issue. James Wilson of Pennsylvania, for example, proposed a method of counting each state's population for purposes of representation. All white people and other free citizens would be counted as one person each. Every five slaves would be counted only as three people. This was called the three-fifths rule. The delegates accepted it. The word slave was never used in the Constitution. The document simply used the words all other persons. The three-fifths rule remained the law until the 14th Amendment to the Constitution came into effect in 1868. Alexander Hamilton said the three-fifths compromise was necessary. Without it, he said, no union could possibly have been formed. Slavery also became an issue when the delegates began discussing the powers of the national legislature. Once again, the delegates asked, are slaves people, or are they property? The answer would affect import taxes and the growth of new states. The delegates accepted several compromises on these questions, too. They agreed that the Treasury could collect a tax of $10 for every imported slave. They also agreed that slaves could be imported until 1808. Then, no new slaves could be brought into the country. Until then, each state had the power to make its own decisions about slavery. After 1808, the national government would make all the decisions. Constitutional law professor Akhil Reed Amar says that agreement is where the delegates went wrong.
What was the founders' biggest mistake? Not that they didn't get rid of slavery immediately. It was already a part of their world. It would have been difficult to get rid of slavery immediately. But what they didn't do is come up with a long-term plan to get rid of slavery eventually.
Debate on the Constitution continued through the summer of 1787. At the same time, some of the delegates raised an important question. Once the document was written, who would approve it? The state legislatures? The people? Or, as Governor Morris proposed, one big national convention? Elbridge Gerry opposed giving that power to the people. The people, he said, have the wildest ideas of government in the world. James Madison disagreed. He believed the people must ratify their new plan of government. Madison considered the difference between a system founded on the legislatures only and one founded on the people to be the true difference between a league or treaty and a constitution. When the debate was over, the delegates agreed that the people should ratify the new constitution through conventions held in each state. Justice Clarence Thomas and law professor Akhil Reed Amar have described this agreement as one of the most remarkable parts of the convention.
You think of the going to Washington and trying to get him to leave Mount Vernon, and he doesn't want to leave because he's finally back home. He'd been away over 4 years, and he didn't want to leave. And he goes to Philadelphia, and they do it. They come up with this document, 4 months, and now you have it. It's going to the Congress, and it's going to be sent to the people, too.
To the people.
To the people, amazing. To ratify.
Amazing.
Finally, the delegates had to decide how many yes votes by states would be needed to ratify the Constitution. Any changes to the Articles of Confederation needed ratification by all 13 states. The Philadelphia Convention was called only to change those articles, not to replace them. So all 13 states would have to approve. But several delegates said this would be impossible. After all, Rhode Island never sent a representative to Philadelphia. That state was sure to reject the Constitution. Also, as everyone knew, the Philadelphia Convention went far past the point of changing the Articles of Confederation. The delegates wrote a completely new plan of government. But that meant they could agree to accept ratification by fewer than 13 states. Delegates who supported a strong central government wanted to quickly put the question to a vote. How many states were needed to ratify? By the end of the day, the convention had not decided. But early the next day, the delegates voted, and the number they agreed on was 9. The convention in Philadelphia was nearing the end of its work. The delegates needed only to write out their agreements in final form and sign the document.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. You can find more stories on the Learning English website at learningenglish.voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. I'm Anna Mateo.